holds greater significance than previous years, earning mass participation in rallies across Iran. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei says huge marches on the Quds Day will prove the falsehood of anti-Iran propaganda spread by enemies of the nation. In his video statement, Ayatollah Khamenei stressed that the Quds Day March has always been a symbol of unity and strength of the Iranian nation. He added that the march also demonstrates the nation's steadfastness and resilience in upholding its important political and fundamental goals, reaffirming its unwavering support for Palestine. The leader concluded by expressing hope that this year's Quds Day March would be one of the best, most magnificent, and most honorable in recent years. Across Iran's territorial waters, a powerful display of maritime solidarity has unfolded. One day prior to International Quds Day, the IRGC Navy and Basij volunteer forces staged a massive parade, sending a clear message of support to the people of Palestine and condemning Israeli atrocities in Gaza. From the Persian Gulf to the Caspian Sea, vessels flew the Palestinian flag alongside the Iranian banner. Fatemeh Masumi tells us more.
Under a unified sky, the territorial waters of Iran mirror a nation's resolve, coming alive as over 3,000 naval vessels participate in a monumental naval parade, showcasing unwavering support for Palestine. The massive parade also demonstrates the strength and readiness of IRGC's naval forces, sending a strong message to adversaries just one day prior to International Quds Day rallies. This is not just a show of maritime prowess, but a symbol of solidarity, with the flags of Iran and Palestine waving proudly.
This is the fourth year that the naval parade is being held to mark the occasion, featuring civilian vessels from volunteer forces alongside other naval ships. First and foremost, this event sends a strong message of solidarity with Palestine. It also demonstrates to the Caspian Sea littoral states that this body of water represents friendship. Also, it demonstrates that Iran is always ready to support its people and protect its sovereignty against threats, as the parade is taking place simultaneously along the coast of the Persian Gulf and the Sea of Oman.
The parade, conducted simultaneously in Iran's territorial waters from the Persian Gulf and the Sea of Oman to the Caspian Sea, features a variety of vessels, from advanced naval warships to smaller boats manned by Basij volunteer forces, all proudly displaying the flag of Palestine next to the Iranian banner.
The event you are witnessing today is a naval parade conducted by the Iranian Navy and volunteer forces. Here at our naval base, 150 vessels of volunteer forces and 30 vessels from the IRGC Navy's northern base are participating in the parade in the north. This parade demonstrates solidarity with the oppressed people of Palestine and condemns the atrocities committed by the Israeli regime in Gaza. Additionally, it aims to showcase the military strength of the volunteer forces and to enhance unity among the various branches of the armed forces.
Ahead of International Quds Day rallies, this maritime demonstration has tuned into an annual tradition, underscoring the enduring bond between Iran and Palestine.
And that's the message from Iran's territorial waters: unity, strength, and unwavering support for Palestine ahead of Quds Day, showcasing Iran's maritime resolve and solidarity to the world. Fatemeh Masumi, Babolsar.
The leader of Yemen, Ansarullah, has called upon all Arab nations to recognize the threat posed by Israel's expansionist ambitions. Abdul Malik al-Houthi said the regime's ambitions extend beyond Palestine and include other Arab countries. Houthi was speaking on the eve of the International Quds Day. He said this year's Quds Day is marked with unprecedented Israeli attacks on Palestinians in Gaza. He urged Arab countries to take action to nullify the threat posed by Israel. He cautioned regional countries against falling into U.S. trap, warning that Washington seeks to exploit them for Israel's benefit. Houthi also warned that Israel is taking political and media measures in partnership with the U.S. to eradicate the Palestinian cause through genocide, destruction, and starvation. He called for a collective action to confront and counteract the regime's expansionist policies, emphasizing the importance of unity and vigilance among Arab states. Houthi concluded by reaffirming Yemen's unwavering support for the Palestinian cause and its commitment to resisting foreign aggression. Yemeni political commentator Hossein al-Bukhaiti says Houthi is calling on all Arab nations to take a stand on their feet and take action against the Israeli regime's expansionist agenda.
He has warned that the Israeli expansion is not only in Gaza, it's as well going into the West Bank, even though before the so-called Tufan al-Aqsa against the Zionist State of Israel, and as well in Lebanon. We know that Lebanon has signed an agreement with the Zionist State, but still the Zionist has not actually withdrawn from some areas in south of Lebanon, and they continue to bomb Lebanon. And as well, he has mentioned the Syria, how the Israeli regime is expanding their forces in Syria, south of Syria, south of Damascus, and all that area with the border with the Palestine, even though the new regime in Syria has not shown any aggression against the Zionist State of Israel. This is a clear message to all the Arab, even though if you have an agreement with the Israeli, they will do whatever it takes to expand, they will do whatever it takes to continue attack you and destroy your country, and maybe it will be the turn of other countries like Egypt, like Jordan. And as well, he has called all Arabs, he said that they are actually waiting for permission from the United States and the Zionist State of Israel to bring food and medicine and bread and fuel and water to the people in Gaza.
The United States presses ahead with its aggression against Yemen, launching new airstrikes on various areas across the Arab country. According to Yemeni media, fresh strikes targeted Yemen's capital, hitting a military facility south of Sana'a with 4 attacks. Areas close to Sana'a International Airport were also hit, in addition to 2 districts in south and center of Sana'a Governorate. American warplanes also conducted 3 raids on Hodeida Governorate. Sa'ada Governorate was the main focus of fresh U.S. airstrikes. Yemen's Sabah news agency reported 7 airstrikes on the Al-Safra and Al-Saldam districts in Sa'ada Governorate. Local sources said 5 air raids were carried out on Al-Safra district, while Al-Saldam was hit with 2 airstrikes. Jabal al-Sbat district in Amran province was also target of 8 airstrikes, 5 of which hit the telecommunication network, knocking it out of order. There have been no reports on possible casualties yet. The U.S. and its allies have escalated their aggression against Yemen after the country resumed its anti-Israel operations over the regime's renewed genocide in Gaza. Moving on, Israeli forces continue their acts of aggression in Gaza, killing and injuring more civilians across the blockaded territory. One of the latest attacks killed 3 Palestinians and injured several others in the Mawazi area of Khan Yunis in southern Gaza. The regime's artillery fire killed another Palestinian east of the city. An earlier airstrike on a residential area in Beit Lahia in northern Gaza killed nearly 8 dozen civilians. An attack on a Palestinian home north of Gaza City also killed 7 more civilians, including an entire family. World Central Kitchen announced on Thursday that one of its volunteer members was killed and six others were injured in an Israeli strike near one of its kitchens, which was distributing food in Gaza. The regime's renewed onslaught has killed over 830 civilians and wounded nearly 1,800 since March the 18th. The overall death toll from the Israeli genocide now exceeds 50,200, with over 113,900 others injured. Our Gaza correspondent Moti Abu Mosabe joined us earlier with the latest updates on Israeli attacks across the blockaded territory. Let's take a listen.
Yes, unfortunately, the death toll of the Palestinian people being slaughtered on a daily basis by the Israeli occupation forces is still rising incrementally. In light of those ongoing and intensified Israeli strikes and attacks are still, as you know, ubiquitous, targeting various parts of the city. According to the latest updates of the Gaza Health Ministry here, that 40 Palestinian civilians at least have been confirmed killed since dawn hours, still just moment in the shadow of those constant and unstop Israeli attacks and air strikes. And as you know, the fish attack actually was carried out against a gathering of the Palestinian people in Al-Mawasi area in the western part of Khan Yunis City in which two Palestinian civilians were killed. And previously, at least three Palestinian civilians were killed in Khan Yunis city as well, particularly in the eastern section of the city after the Israeli warplanes carried out several airstrikes against that area. And in Gaza city, a short while ago, the Israeli warplanes targeted and destroyed another residential building in At-Tufah neighborhood. And previously, we were talking about an appalling massacre that took place there after the Israeli warplanes targeted a gathering of the Palestinian people in Annafa street in the northern part of Gaza, a city killing at least six Palestinian civilians. And here in the central area of Gaza Strip, the Israeli artillery shelling is still maintained extensively, targeting the eastern parts of the city, particularly the eastern part of the Al-Maghazi refugee camp.
The head of the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees has issued a stark warning over the dire humanitarian situation in Gaza. Felipe Lazzarini says the besieged territory is going through the longest period it has been without any supplies since the Israeli onslaught began. Lazzarini warned that no humanitarian aid has entered Gaza for over 3 weeks, leaving its population without food and medicine and raising fears of further spread of diseases. He said last week, witnessed the single deadliest day in the past 1.5 years in which over 500 Gazans, including many women and children, were killed. Lazzarini added that over 140,000 people have also been forced to leave their homes due to Israel's evacuation orders. The UNRWA chief called for immediate lifting of Gaza's siege and the reopening of its crossings to allow entry of humanitarian aid. He also urged an end to Israeli strikes and renewal of the ceasefire. Palestinian filmmaker Hamdan Bilal, who is the co-director of an Oscar-winning documentary, has been released after being detained by Israeli forces. Bilal was attacked by Israeli settlers in the occupied West Bank before the regime soldiers took him into custody instead of his attackers. His detention has sparked outrage, with human rights organizations condemning the targeting of the Palestinian journalists and filmmakers. Our correspondent Naga Hamid has more.
Israeli authorities have released Palestinian filmmaker Hamdan Bilal, a co-director of the Oscar-winning documentary No Other Land, after detaining him overnight. Bilal was in Susia, a village in the occupied West Bank, when a group of Israeli settlers violently attacked him. Despite his injuries, Israeli soldiers arrested him instead of his assailants.
Settlers and army, they attacking my home and they beating me. They continue to beating me. It's like around between 15, 20 minutes until I was bleeding from all my head and face. And finally, after this attack, they took me to the place. I don't know what is it. I stay there. It's like all the night. They was laughing about me.
Bilal was taken into custody and was held overnight before being released.
On Monday, there was a massive attack on Susia village where my friend and colleague and co-director of No Other Land documentary, Hamdan Bilal, lives. There was an attack in his home and other houses in the village. Settlers and soldiers targeted him precisely to revenge against the success of the movie and against Hamdan as an activist in the village that documenting the attacks of the settlers that happening on his village all the time and other villages in Masafer Yatta. This is not an isolated attack. Attacks happening all the time, but this time it was revenge and attack on Hamdan for his success to try to punish him and to silence him and to prevent him from doing his work.
Bilal's documentary No Other Land, co-directed with Palestinian and Israeli filmmakers, sheds light on the forced displacement of Palestinians. This incident raises further concerns about the growing attacks on Palestinian journalists and activists. As Israeli violence escalates, documenting the reality on the ground is being silenced. Naqa Hamid, Ramallah, Occupied West Bank.
Iran has reiterated that direct negotiations with the U.S. on the country's peaceful nuclear activities are meaningless as long as maximum pressure policy and military threats are in place. Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi was speaking in a phone conversation with his British counterpart, David Lammy, referring to conflicting positions taken by American officials on negotiations with Iran. He rejected instrumental use of diplomacy to exert political and psychological pressure on Tehran. Araghchi also voiced disappointment over unconstructive stances taken by some European countries and the European Union, including the imposition of sanctions on Iran under baseless pretexts. He urged those European countries to reconsider their approach and issue related to the West Asian region. Iran's foreign minister says the country's official response to a letter from U.S. President Donald Trump has been sent through Oman. Abbas Araghchi said the response was sent through a letter that elaborates Iran's viewpoints on the current situation and Trump's letter. He added that Iran's policy is still not engaging in direct negotiations with the U.S. under maximum pressure and military threats. However, Araghchi said indirect negotiations can continue just in the same way they were conducted in the past. Trump revealed in early March that he had sent a letter to Iran. At the same time, he reinstated his maximum pressure policy against Iran by imposing fresh sanctions on the country. Iran has stressed time and again that it won't sit at the negotiating table with the U.S. administration as Trump continues its pressure campaign against Tehran.
From east to west, throughout the vast land of Iran, you're listening to IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
For the better part of two academic years, many colleges and universities across the U.S. have reacted rather than responded to organize the study and struggle against Israeli regime genocide in Palestine. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Please stay tuned for more. The Electronic Intifada wrote, for the better part of two academic years, many colleges and universities across the U.S. have reacted rather than responded to organize the study and struggle against the Zionist regime genocide in Palestine. Most notably, this has included administrative decisions that encouraged and directed the criminalization and brutalization of involved students, staff, and faculty members by campus and municipal police. In so doing, these institutions have all but abandoned their positions of moral authority in exchange for proximity to profits and political power, creating the conditions that led to the abduction of Mahmoud Khalil, a Palestinian and recent graduate of Columbia University, by Federal Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents on March 8. Consistent with even selective First Amendment advocates and constitutional law experts, what happened to Khalil should be deeply concerning to all of college students, especially those in the university. Minimally, the question of how a legal permanent resident, that is, a green card holder, could be summarily detained and held captive by federal agents without due process remains insufficiently answered. And yet, his abduction, which occurred despite having expressed concerns to university officials about ICE or other dangerous individuals coming to his home, demonstrates how an acute focus on legality obscures the interpretive nature of the law by authoritative power. As critical, legal, and critical race theorists have instructed the American people, the law is a tool constructed and commonly wielded or disregarded to preserve the status quo, not change it. In Khalil's case, as well as other less visible and perhaps less horrific instances, both citizenship and student statuses are fraught categories, circumscribed by legalese and racial politics and always already precarious under domestic foreign policy regimes. That is to say, these statuses are conditionally conferred and therefore can be rescinded at discretion of designated authorities and intermediaries, including universities. This is why the established pretext for detaining Khalil has remained without any material evidence of legal wrongdoing. Furthermore, the often parallel processes adjudicated by universities in clandestine disciplinary proceedings lay the predicate for students and others to be targeted by the state for subsequent persecution. As Dima Khalidi, the founder and director of Palestine Legal, wrote for The Nation earlier this month, the university is not merely a site within which civil liberties are routinely violated by outside parties under simple pretexts. Rather, the university has chosen to be an active collaborator and facilitator in the new McCarthyist erosion of legal due process, free speech, and academic freedom, and shared governance to the detriment of its reputation and future relationship to the public sphere. Failing to protect the dignity and material safety of concerned university citizens is a dereliction of duty, particularly dangerous for those systematically and disproportionately rendered vulnerable to harm and violence for exercising their First Amendment right. Even worse, subjecting pro-Palestine activists, including anti-Zionist Jewish students, to pretextual surveillance, police brutality, criminal detention, and deportation is an egregious form of institutional betrayal of civil liberties and the public trust. Without immediate and forceful redirection, these repeated instances of institutional negligence and maleficence will only fortify post-secondary delegitimization, a position from which the higher education enterprise may never fully recover. Lest we forget, colleges and universities' compulsory and anticipatory compliance with anti-democratic directives and fascist executive orders has proven poor strategy for legitimacy and self-preservation. Their compliance has functioned as a permissive and reactionary gesture, one that has expanded rather than constrained or contested authoritarian power. For instance, such impulses did not spur Columbia, Harvard University, or the University of Pennsylvania from public ridicule in the U.S. Congress during the Biden presidency. Nor have they protected dozens of other institutions from being threatened, reprimanded, and in the case of Colombia, effectively sanctioned by the Trump administration. In fact, Colombia has today conceded to the Trump administration's threat to cut $400 million in federal funding by accepting increasing criminalization of its students and the dismantling of academic freedom for its Middle Eastern, South Asian, and African Studies Department. The Colombia administration has made enormous concessions with no certainty of even salvaging the federal funds. This decision by Colombia has set a new precedent for institutional susceptibility to political influence, legislative overreach, moneyed interest, and decreased operational autonomy, especially at colleges and universities more reliant upon federal grants and government programs. More importantly, however, the public trust has been lost following months of compliance and capitulation is far more difficult to replace than research and programmatic funding. Contrary to popular belief, social capital and public confidence are not infinite or unconditional resources. They cannot be easily mobilized with performative rhetoric and non-performative gestures to which many colleges and universities have grown accustomed. So, what becomes of the university when it is stripped of its resources while exhausting the goodwill of its students and its workers? What value does compliance actually offer when it fails to prevent the incapacitation of college and university research functions? More importantly, are relinquishing moral authority and accepting moral bankruptcy too costly a price for an uncertain future under increasingly authoritarian rule? These are the animating questions higher education administrators need to be considering as they assess the cost-benefit of their actions in the weeks and months ahead. For certain, and as the current President and Secretary of State have made clear, what has already transpired is the first of many affronts to civil liberties and the institutions entrusted to uphold them. What colleges and universities do next, in the courts and on their campuses, may very well determine whether higher education and the American Democratic Project will survive long enough to pursue a redeemable future.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, Allah's forgiveness in Ramadan. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, welcome to A to Z with me, Sister Zainab, here on IB English Radio. And obviously the title tells us it's, yeah. So this is about Allah's forgiveness. And obviously Allah is the most forgiving. And during the month of Ramadan, very special things happen. And so I'm just going to go through some of these very special things, because I think being aware of the extra forgiveness that Allah sort of gives to people during the month of Ramadan might then also make us even more inclined to be doing the good things and to be avoiding anything that's bad in any way. So obviously there is this special promise of Allah's pardon during this holy month of Ramadan, according to traditions. So, for example, and I'm just going to list some of these traditions, and I don't know if everyone's aware of these. They're very beautiful. So, for example, it said that Allah pardons 70 million people who would otherwise be punished in hell at the time of iftar each night during Ramadan. So just think to yourself, so every night, every single night of those 30 nights of Ramadan, each time there's iftar, that evening, 70 million people, so 70 million of us Muslims, are being pardoned. So that's every night. So just do the maths yourself. Then it said that at the end of Ramadan, Allah also forgives an additional number of sinners, equivalent to that total sum of those that he'd already pardoned during the month. So obviously you've got on 30 nights, each of those 30 nights, 70 million people are being pardoned. And then Allah at the end of the month will be pardoning that same amount again. So this is huge. Welcome back. This is A to Z and IB English Radio, me, Sister Zainab, and I'm talking particularly about Allah's huge, massive forgiveness during the holy month of Ramadan. And so obviously I've just quoted the one tradition where every night 70 million people are pardoned from being punished in hell, and then the equivalent amount to that whole month again at the end of the month. And then there's other narrations, and like I was literally going to sit down and do the math for this, but I thought, no, I'll let you do the math. But it's quite amazing. So some narrations also say that Allah forgives whoever he pleases on the first night of Ramadan, whoever. Now, Allah could forgive one believer. Allah could also forgive every single believer. It's up to Allah. And then, after that first night of Ramadan, Allah will forgive twice the number he pardoned the previous night. And this goes on every single night. So basically, it's a doubling every single day. And then, on the very last night of Ramadan, he will forgive twice the number of people he pardoned during the whole month that had just passed. So again, huge numbers. So what does this tell us? So Allah is basically inviting us to just do what we can. And obviously just the very fact that we're fasting will be pleasing to Allah and will invite mercy from Allah. But obviously if we can, in a sense, get our act together and really polish away some of those bad traits we have, try to establish good habits, at least get rid of bad habits and maybe even establish some good habits. So by bad habits, maybe a little one that many of us have, snapping at people. You know, we get a little bit annoyed at someone, all of a sudden we've just said something a little bit harsh, and it can hurt people. So maybe that's something we could work on. Another thing, good thing, just staying in touch even with distant relatives, just sending them a message, calling them every so often. Yeah, anything. Just look at how much mercy is waiting for us. So I pray that everyone is able to benefit from this, remind themselves of this ocean of mercy that is awaiting all of us in the holy month of Ramadan. And I also look forward to welcoming you to another episode of A to Z here on Arab English Radio. And farewell for now. Thank you very much for listening to this episode of A to Z. And for more information, please also visit our website at www.iranradio.ir.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
In the limelight.
Benjamin Netanyahu's horrific resumption of the war on Gaza shows that no U.S.-backed ceasefire deal is worth the paper it is printed on. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Please stay tuned for the first part. Middle East Eye wrote, at 2:20 a.m. on Tuesday local time in the Gaza Strip, Washington inaugurated a new era in world politics. This was the moment Israel timed its attacks on dozens of targets in the enclave to coincide with Suhoor. the pre-dawn meal eaten by Muslims in preparation for a day of fasting. The timing was designed to inflict maximum civilian casualties as families across Gaza gathered to eat and pray during the holy month of Ramadan, even if they had little or no food to consume. The mass simultaneous attacks on 100 separate locations achieved their objective, making it one of the worst acts of wanton butchery by Israeli regime forces during the 15-month war on Gaza. More than 400 Palestinians were killed, including more than 170 children, according to Gaza health officials. The Zionist regime Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu sought and got a green light from Washington before launching these attacks. U.S. President Donald Trump thus signaled a new era in global affairs by giving his consent for a wave of attacks that broke every aspect of the ceasefire deal signed in the presence of international guarantors. In one act, Trump turned the West that his nation claims to lead into the Wild West. From this moment on, no treaty, ceasefire, or international agreement that the U.S. regime signs is worth the paper it is printed on. A U.S. president who persuaded the people of Michigan that he was a man of peace and even the next potential recipient of the Nobel Peace Prize now uses the label Palestinian as a political slur against Jewish Democratic politicians. The president who vowed to stop all wars has launched or permitted airstrikes in Yemen, Gaza, Lebanon, and Syria simultaneously and is promising that all hell will break loose on other countries if they do not submit to his demands. A U.S. president who told the families of the hostages that he would do everything in his power to get them back alive has allowed the Zionist regime to effectively apply its Hannibal directive to the two dozen who, before Tuesday morning's attacks, were believed to be living. If the Zionist regime behaves like this, what incentive does it now give Hamas to keep the remaining hostages alive? For Netanyahu, the timing of these attacks was everything for quite different reasons. On Tuesday, he was due to appear in court on multiple corruption charges, which as the case progresses, are tightening a noose around his political neck. The renewed war gave him an excuse to tell the court he could not attend. As Ahmad Tibi, a Knesset member and chairman of the Tall Party, writes in the Middle East Eye, it is no coincidence that Tuesday's bombardment comes just before a key budget vote, with ultra-Orthodox lawmakers threatening to topple the government if a law excluding their community from conscription is not passed, and former National Security Minister Itamar Ben-Gvir issuing ultimatums. Bezalel Smotrich, Netanyahu's finance minister and leader of the extremist religious Zionist party, was right all along when he assured the world that Netanyahu would resume the war in Gaza. Recently, Smotrich said the hostage families had been hurt too much during a clash at the Knesset with Ayala Metzger, the daughter-in-law of a slain captive, Yoran Metzger, saying, "We thought that we were serving in the Israeli army and not the army of God's vengeance. In these very moments, we are murdering hostages and there is a deal on the table." But for the religious Zionists, who now form the single most powerful group in Israel, the Army of God's Vengeance is exactly what the Gaza campaign is all about. They have done everything in their power to make a dispute over land into a religious war. For years, they have pushed police to attack worshippers at Al-Aqsa Mosque during Ramadan, directly prompting the Al-Aqsa Storm Operation, which the group dubbed Operation Al-Aqsa Flood. Hamas is proscribed as a terrorist group in the UK and other countries in the West. Even the bitterest of foes can agree to stop fighting during religious festivals. But the Zionist regime recently did not just renege on a ceasefire deal it had signed. It specifically targeted worshippers gathered to perform a religious ritual. If the Zionist regime is a small settler colonial beachhead in a region entirely surrounded by Muslims, this attempt to turn the conflict into a religious one represents folly of suicidal proportions. The flame it has lit in all Muslim hearts will be hard to extinguish. It will be equally hard, if not impossible, for the survivors of this attack to consider a common future with Israeli Jews in either two states or one state. Despite its actions on October 7, 2023, the resistance movement Hamas remains, in view of most military analysts, a disciplined militia that sticks to the agreements it signs. It is the child killer regime of Israel that is acting like an undisciplined force of terror, violating an internationally recognized deal multiple times. Even before the Zionist regime's recent attack, the Israeli regime had killed more than 150 Palestinians in Gaza during the ceasefire. It failed to start talks regarding Stage 2 on the 16th day of Stage 1, as prescribed in the deal. It failed to fulfill its commitment to withdraw from the Philadelphia Corridor. It delayed the release of Palestinian prisoners for a week. The Zionist regime has behaved like a mafia, attempting to bully Gaza into a different deal altogether. It formulated a proposal, which it put in the mouth of Steve Witkoff, although there was no word of endorsement from Trump's envoy, and demanded that Hamas release 11 living hostages and half of the dead in return for a 50-day ceasefire. This would have been a completely different deal from the one negotiated by Qatari and Egyptian mediators over months.
Andrew Irving. Knowing neither the enemy nor yourself, you will succumb in every battle.
Let's see that backwards.
Kyrie Andrew Irving was born on March 23, 1992, in Melbourne, Australia. When he was just 2 years old, his family migrated to New Jersey, the United States. Kyrie lost his mother when he was 4 years old. His father had to raise him with the help of his sister. Kyrie started his professional basketball career in 2010 with the Duke Blue Devils basketball team at his university. Only 1 year was enough for his exceptional talent to catch the eyes of coaches in a professional American league known as the NBA.
My mom passed away when I was young, so my dad had to raise my sister and I alone. He was a great player. He even tried out for Boston once.
Irving's rise to stardom in the NBA began with the Cleveland Cavaliers, a team that had previously hosted stars like LeBron James. His brilliance was such that by the end of the season, he won the NBA Rookie of the Year award. This award is given annually by the National Basketball Association to the most successful rookie player in each season.
With the first pick in the 2011 NBA Draft, the Cleveland Cavaliers select Kyrie Irving from Duke University.
Irving plays in the point guard position. The Cleveland Cavaliers set a record with 26 consecutive losses in the 2010-2011 season, the longest losing streak among NBA teams. However, this same team won the NBA championship for the first time in 2016. One of Irving's masterpieces dates back to the 2016 finals in the game against the great Golden State Warriors team. In the crucial and final seconds, with the game tied 89 apiece, he made a beautiful three-point shot, leading the Cavaliers to their first historic championship, a moment that gained worldwide fame.
It's over! The Cavaliers are NBA champions! The drought is over! The curse destroyed! 52 years of torment and anguish has been washed away!
Following this success, the Boston Celtics acquired Irving. The prestigious team with 17 championships is the second most successful team in the NBA after the Los Angeles Lakers. Kyrie shined for 2 years with the Celtics, thrilling the stadium with his amazing moves in every game. He then joined the Brooklyn Nets. Now, at 32 years old, Kyrie Irving plays for the Dallas Mavericks. He's considered one of the best current NBA players and one of the best in the world. He is especially known for his dribbling skills, particularly the crossover move. Irving is often referred to as the best dribbler in NBA history. Some also regard him as the best shooter on earth. In one game, a commentator, impressed by Irving's extraordinary moves, even described him as non-human and possessing superhuman abilities. Irving has many fans worldwide due to his playing style and is even popular in video games. He has over 20 million followers on Instagram. In recent years, changes in Irving's behavior and demeanor have led to rumors about him, rumors suggesting that Kyrie Irving has changed his religion. However, it is still uncertain what religion he has converted to.
Welcome back to Boston. As you can see, the sun is setting here officially at 7:31 p.m. Showing you an assistant coach for the Celtics pointing to their watch, probably indicating that very thing. Kyrie Irving going to the back. Now, we all know that he has fasted in the past. He has said publicly he wants to keep things private about his Ramadan observance. But I will tell you this. If he is fasting, he had to wait till sunset before he could intake any food or liquid. And as we just told you, sunset just passed. It's been 13 hours and 36 minutes.
Speculations continued, and day by day, new and clearer signs of Irving's chosen religion emerged. Finally, in 2021, Kyrie Irving officially announced in a press conference that he had converted to Islam. Irving responded to a basketball reporter's question about how he could fast and play professional sports at the same time.
Well, it's a journey with God, and I'm not alone in this. I have brothers and sisters all around the world that are fasting with me, We hold our prayers and our meditations very sacred. And when you come out here, I mean, God's inside me. God's inside you. God's inside all of us. So I'm walking with faith, and that's all that matters. And when I get a chance to do this in this type of arena and showcase my talents that have been granted to me strictly from God, I'm humbled.
For a star, it doesn't matter what position they are in. They shine in any case. In addition to professional sports, Irving has also shown his talent in the field of cinema, just like Eric Cantona, the French football star. In 2012, Irving played the role of Uncle Drew in a famous commercial film. Later, in 2015, he wrote and directed the script for the role himself. The commercial film received so much attention that eventually, in 2017, a feature film with the same name, Uncle Drew, was made in Hollywood in the comedy genre. Irving and several NBA basketball stars acted in this film. In addition to Uncle Drew, Irving has also acted in several other films and TV series, such as Kick It. Irving even ventured into voice acting at one point. In an episode of the animated series We Bare Bears, he voiced his own character. Irving may have a special talent for acting, but he has shown that his inclination towards Islam is by no means superficial. When in Ramadan 2021, the Israeli regime bombed the fasting people of Gaza, as in previous years, only a few days had passed since Irving had converted to Islam. From the very beginning, he faced a tough challenge and, by reacting to this crime, showed he had wholeheartedly and consciously connected himself to the Muslim community. At that time, he supported and backed Palestinians with emphatic and supportive posts on his social media pages. As usual, this expression of opinion caused Zionist groups to become flustered and take a stance against Irving, as any celebrity's support for Palestine is considered a threat to the legitimacy of the Israeli regime. For example, a pro-Zionist Twitter page named Sports Rabbi wrote that Kyrie Irving needs to get an education before opining on the Middle East. Additionally, the American Zionist magazine, The Nation, headlined that Kyrie Irving's comments on Palestine are a big deal. The magazine further writes that basketball savant has called for the bombs to stop, as well as new international humanism. Irving did not merely settle for silent reactions on social media. In a press conference, he responded to sports journalists' questions by saying that recent events in Palestine had caused him to lose much of his sports focus and that basketball had lost its importance to him at that time.
How did it feel to be, again, so close to full strength as you get ready to wrap up the season?
Felt good, you know, just to get out there, play the game that we love. But, you know, for me personally, I'm not really, I'm not going to lie to you guys. A lot of stuff is going on in this world, and basketball is just not the most important thing to me right now. There's a lot of stuff going on overseas. All my people are still in bondage all across the world, and there's a lot of dehumanization going on. So, you know, I apologize if I'm not going to be focused on y'all questions. You know, it's just too much going on in the world for me to just be talking about basketball. Like, I got focused on this shit 24/7 most of the time, but it's just too much going on in this world not to address. You know, it's sad to see this shit going on. And I just try to pay it forward as best I can by speaking out, by doing things behind the scenes, you know, just living by action, really. And it's a unique balance because you're in a platform or you're in an industry where a lot of people that are surrounding it or observe it don't really get a chance to say what they really believe in. You know, they have to play it safe or they have to worry about money, or they have to worry about what people are saying. You know, so many people are criticizing what they say, and really you just got to say it's just not right what's going on in the world. We're so divided and separated. It's just getting ridiculous now. You know, so many people are just choosing one side or the other, and I'm just here to say I'm on the side with God. You know, I'm siding with God. Just treat every human being the way you expect to be treated, no matter who they are, what they look like, where they come from. If you truly believe in standing as one, then you would stand with us and fighting against us.
One of Irving's most controversial stances dates back to October 27th, 2022, when he expressed support for the Black Hebrew Israelite doctrine. Irving shared a documentary titled Hebrews to Negroes, Wake Up Black America in one of his tweets. The 2018 film, based on a book of the same name, promotes anti-Zionist ideology of the Black Hebrew Israelites. The Black Hebrew Israelites are a group that claims to be the true descendants of the ancient Israelites, asserting that real Jews are black people. They argue that modern-day Jews are not genuine descendants of the Israelites. The global Jewish community does not recognize this group as Jewish and often treats them harshly. Interestingly, the illegitimate Israeli regime, itself an occupying force, does not even allow the minority Black Hebrew community to remain in Palestine, a situation that can be seen as one of history's situational comedies. Irving's supportive post about the Black Hebrew minority was enough to spark significant controversy, with Zionists accusing him of anti-Semitism. The situation escalated to the point where pro-Zionist lobbies pressured Amazon to remove the book and film Hebrews to Negroes, Wake Up Black America from its platform. However, Amazon has not taken such action thus far.
All eyes are on Amazon, which has yet to take down an anti-Semitic film shared by a well-known basketball player. I spoke to the director of the Religious Action Center of Reform Judaism, who says companies should not be profiting off hate.
After pressure from pro-Zionist lobbies, the Brooklyn Nets announced that they would suspend their cooperation with this player for at least 5 games without pay. However, the penalty and Irving's strategic and intelligent apology, which did not show any retreat from his original stance, did not satisfy the Zionists. They considered the waves created by such figures as normalizing anti-Semitism. Various pressure from Zionist lobbies to the FBI director and the NBA commissioner did not cause Irving to back down from his original idea.
FBI Director Christopher Wray recently said the Bureau is fighting against anti-Semitism, saying more than 60% of religious hate crimes are sparked by anti-Semitism.
Now, the threats may be coming from all sides, but we're hitting back at them full force, and we're doing it from multiple FBI programs.
After this unprecedented amount of pressure, Irving again tweeted on October 29, 2022, stating that the anti-Semitic label that is being pushed on him is not justified, adding, "I embrace and want to learn from all walks of life and religions." Irving denied any religious bias and defended his initial tweet. He said that history is not meant to be hidden from anyone. "I'm not going to stand down on anything that I believe in. I'm only going to get stronger because I'm not alone. I have a whole army around me." These words from Irving were enough for the Black Hebrew Israelites to take to the streets in support of Irving. They showed what Irving meant by gaining the strength of a whole army. The support for Irving has shown that the era of Zionist lobbies dominating unchallenged is over. With increased public awareness, an independent movement has emerged in Western societies that can act as a shield for anti-Zionist voices against Zionist pressure. The Zionist struggle to silence the wave Irving started was not without reason. The Irving wave achieved its impact, drawing in one of America's most famous rappers, Kanye West, who has 32 million followers. By defending Irving's ideas, West brought even more attention to the controversy. West, who has previously faced criticism from Israelis and Zionist lobbies for his anti-Zionist statements, was once again accused of anti-Semitism and faced boycotts from certain brands.
I could say anti-Semitic things and Adidas can't drop me. Now what? Now what?
Of course, it was clear that Kanye West, like Irving, had thought through his stance carefully. In a clever tweet, he responded to all criticism